Monster Man, Special Episode, Monsters of the Guild Build.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Nathan. If you'd like to be like Nathan and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get my other podcast, Patron Deities, which has over 100 episodes of me talking about the Deities and Demigods supplement for AD&D First Edition, but more broadly, kind of religion and mythology and how to use them in your games. So, Nathan, thank you very much. I'm really glad that you're enjoying the show enough to want to support it, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. So, when we discussed what Nathan would like me to talk about as his special episode, Nathan noticed that he and I are both members of the same Facebook group. And this Facebook group is called the Tabletop Crafters Guild, and given how many thousands upon thousands of members it has, it wouldn't surprise me if some of my other listeners were also members. And what this is it was kind of formed from the followings of different RPG and wargaming crafters YouTube. So these are people who are like miniature painters, but more commonly like terrain makers and model makers. And as you know, I am someone who likes to use miniatures a lot in my games, and I also like to make things at home for cheap rather than, you know, buy expensive things because, you know, like miniatures and terrain can be pretty expensive. So for me, this rose out of a desire to economize, but also it's just something that I really enjoy. You know, I love the creativity of it. I love improvisation in general. So it sort of fits in with my other kind of aesthetic principles, I guess. So every month, over on the Tabletop Crafters Guild, they have what's called a guild build, which is basically like a suggested theme for something to make for all the members. And everybody just kind of like, creates things and shares images of the things that they've created. And then I guess they're judged. I've actually never entered myself, but it's just kind of a shared project that everybody can work on together and, you know, and kind of compare their results. And Nathan sent me a link to a particular guild build, which was from September 2019. And this was relevant to the show because what they were making was monsters. So this is going to be an episode that has a visual accompaniment. Now, I'm going to put a link to the YouTube video in the show notes. It's pretty short. It's under 4 minutes long. And it shows a lot of cool looking different monsters. And there's so many monsters in this video that I've decided to focus only on the top five, the five winners. Basically, the judges' favorites, the five finalists, I guess I should say. So if you want to pop over there and take a look at all that good stuff, go ahead and do that. But then just kind of, you can skip ahead to about 2:50. That's when the five finalists begin. And that's the five models that I'm going to be talking about. So they're not credited in the video, so I'm not sure who made them. But I'm sure that if you go look at the Guild Build posts, it'll show you. You know, these are just models. So, you know, we've never really dealt with a model before, I think, that was just an illustration. So I thought I'd kind of have a look at what I would do with these monsters in a game. I think one of the things that's, before we start, I think one of the things that's interesting is that this method of crafting lends itself to certain kind of aesthetics more than others. So it lends itself to composite monsters, because of course that's one way to kind of create a new monster out of different models or toys, is to just combine them. It lends itself towards surreal monsters. It lends itself to gigantic monsters, because then you can use things that are intended for a different scale. If you've got some like safari animal play toys, but they're not the right scale for miniatures, they're not like 28 millimeter or approximately 1/56 scale, then you can just be like, oh, well, this is a giant ibex. And it lends itself toward like surreal or natural aesthetics rather than, you know, if you're crafting from scratch, it's easier to do maybe some of the more naturalistic forms that we'll see here. Just because the materials are more available than hardline work like you would see with someone wearing a lot of armor. My next door neighbor has just started playing music really loud, so hopefully you cannot hear it in this recording, but if you can, I'm sorry about that. Not that it's unreasonable for him to be playing his music at the time of day that I'm recording. We don't share the same taste in music, but hopefully the recording will have, I'll have filtered it out by this point. I've done my best. Okay, so first up we have number 5, the Clockwork Weaving Spider. So this is like a large mechanical construct. I really like the fact that it incorporates like an actual thread spool. That's really nice. It also has a lot of the sort of craft shop gears. If you go to a hobby store in the US, and probably here too, you will see lots of these little like bundles of gears and bits, and you can also order them on eBay. And they've been used to give this thing kind of a mechanical appearance. It's a good example of a large creature composed of individual shapes and elements, which is a technique that naturally evokes a mechanical or arthropod structure. And it works well as well because we associate spiders with machines. You know, spiders and insects, kind of the way that they move, the fact that their bodies consist of like hard segments makes them look mechanical a little bit to us. And of course, we associate spiders with weaving. In fact, web and weave come from the same root. And also, you know, spiders are symbols of conspiracy, you know, the spider in his web. And weaving is, of course, a symbol of industrialization, so that tells us something about the kind of feeling that this monster is going to convey. So, you know, are we looking at some kind of industrial machine that's been possessed by a spider spirit? You know, if the activities of the weavers have, like, summoned a spider spirit into the machine, is this some kind of extraplanar creature? Maybe one whose web catches travelers between the planes? So, you know, you're in your little interplanar traveling capsule, your flying carpet or wherever, but bam, you hit this spider's web, only you discover that it's made out of rope rather than silk, you know, but it's just coated with some kind of sticky adhesive that this thing, you know, pumps out of a spigot. Is this like the ordinary fauna of some kind of, you know, steampunk giant city? I think steampunk giant works okay. In general, I like not combining two kind of like iconic keywords, but one of the big parts of the kind of steampunk aesthetic, at least in its sort of like industrial city horror mode, is conveying to people the sense of overpowering scale. There's something horrible about being in this city where the buildings are so tall and the machines are so huge and you feel very small. So large scale and industrial imagery kind of go together well. It also made me think of the spider spirits in the old Werewolf the Apocalypse RPG. In Werewolf the Apocalypse, there are kind of these different great spiritual forces, and one of them, the Weaver, is the spiritual force of stasis. It traps things and keeps them as they are. It's kind of like the basic level of its sort of like spiritual servants are these little spider spirits. And so this could be an example of a very large example of one of them. I think that's quite cool. I think this is a great monster because it draws on images that fit together naturally in our minds. You know, it sort of makes sense to us that spiders are a little bit like robots. Number 4 is the Moon Giants. I get kind of a Moomin vibe off these two. They have some cartoonish features, like the very large eyes, the hands with fewer fingers. I think they only have 3 fingers on their hands, or maybe 4. Their poses are quite passive. Pose is a very important part of this kind of modeling because it tells you something about the mood of the creature. You know, if you are going to have a monster object that is only capable of holding one pose, then obviously you need to have that pose represent the feel that you want the encounter to have, and these guys seem more curious than aggressive in terms of their posture. Or maybe not even curious, maybe just kind of enigmatic, like they're passing you by. You can see this a little bit in the photograph, I think. The dark background and light foreground to me suggest a nighttime scene, and the lack of a mouth suggests that these creatures might have difficulty communicating. If you look at the character model in the foreground, it doesn't even really look like he's fighting them, right? More looks like he's startled to see them, like the Moon Giants are just passing by as this adventurer and his companions travel through the landscape. It's just kind of an eerie sight. It creates an overall impression of these like towering, silent figures moving through a moonlit clearing. This is a good example of using a monster to build atmosphere rather than to create conflict. You know, if you are entering a kind of weird fairyland, then it makes sense that you would have encounters with strange creatures that don't necessarily present challenges for you. So an example of this would be the difference between like encountering the T-Rex in Jurassic Park and encountering like, is it the Brontosaurus, where they're just like looking at this herd of majestic creatures going by. I mean, it's working off feelings we already all have about dinosaurs, but it's also just a way of setting the scene. Now, this is interesting because in general, that's not how we think of miniatures, right? We think of miniatures as things that are used to represent tactical positions when you play a game, rather than things that are there to kind of create visual atmosphere. But I feel like they can work equally well in creating visual atmosphere as in representing tactical position. I mean, realistically, if you want to just show the tactics of a game, you don't need miniatures. You can use poker chips or M&Ms, or you could print out little paper counters and stick them to, you know, little MDF circles or whatever. You could do it completely 2D. We use miniatures because we like them. We use them because it's an artistic hobby, and we justify that hobby to ourselves by saying that it's useful in game. And it is useful in game. It's like eating the tomatoes from your garden is very rewarding, but gardening is a hobby for most people, and it just has a fun side benefit of tomatoes. I do think that in general it helps if these characters are, you know, not just silent titans passing you by, but have some kind of other, like, interactable, you know, maybe they're on some kind of quest and they need your help. You know, maybe they rarely come down to Earth from the moon, but they're looking for, like, a lost one of their people, or they have something to trade, you know, and they should have something to trade that's, like, equally strange, right? Gems of moonlight or water from the lunar sea or something like that. You know, they absolutely should not have, like, gold pieces. They give an impression, and I don't know why, but they give an impression of slowness. And I think you want to play it that way. It's interesting because if they were realized in a different way or posed in a different way, they could seem quite Muppety and sort of high energy, but they don't read that way from this image. Okay, coming in at number three, we have the Gaussgeist. Now, the Gaussgeist seems like a creature made of wires and cables with a baleful glowing eye, and is an interesting companion piece, in my opinion, to the Clockwork Weaving Spider, because they're both creatures that exist in an obviously kind of industrial context, but they're very, very different from each other. So the mechanical creature, the Clockwork Weaving Spider, is visibly a machine, even if an implausible one, while the electrical one is a geist, a spirit, and it has a physical design. It's kind of swooping or curving, a bit like a snake, that suggests a fluid movement. And I believe, although I'm not a historian of science, that is how people used to conceptualize electrical current, as like a liquid. I think another part of the difference here is that the spider draws on the similarities between machines and arthropods, but it looks like natural is not the right word, but all the parts look like they're doing what they're supposed to, right? The joints are turning, the legs are poking, the thread spool is spinning, and so on. It's made of gears and doodads that, even though they don't really move, give it the impression of something that should move. So despite the fact that they're equally fantastic, the Gaussgeist looks uncanny compared to the Clockwork Weaving Spider, because all of its wires and whatnot are moving, even though they are not supposed to be moving. It's the difference between, like, an animated suit of armor, which walks around and clanks, and that's fine. I mean, it's not fine, it's spooky, because there's no one in it. But the spooky comes from a different source, because this thing is humaniform, it's got joints, it sort of looks like it should be moving. As opposed to something like Chip from Beauty and the Beast, right? Like, a little teacup is not supposed to move in that way, which grants Chip an air of potentially the uncanny, but in the actual film, the absurd. So I think the Gaussgeist is a fantastic example of a monster that has this kind of, like, presumptive malevolence to it because it's transgressive by existing. When you look at it, you think, ooh, that should not be doing that. So it could be the case that, again, you know, maybe these are spirits of lightning or whatever, that, you know, as mortals have developed these new technologies, they're being drawn toward the electrical current that runs through them. I sort of get the impression that it's a predator, and I think that's from the posture, right? The kind of lowered head gives it that feeling that you get from a humanoid form moving in a non-humanoid way. The position with the head kind of lower than the back as it kind of curves towards something, you know, it looks like it's flowing through water. So the idea of a malevolent spirit that, like, runs down the wires until it finds something big enough for it to animate, I think is really cool. I always really liked in the old Palladium Beyond the Supernatural RPG, the Tectonic Entity, which is kind of like a poltergeist that sort of builds itself a body out of whatever happens to be around. So often they would kind of make themselves junk bodies in a scrapyard or something, right? Anywhere that there's a suitable amount of inanimate material that's just kind of loose and lying around. So I like the Gaussgeist. Again, it's a case where the aesthetic implies what it's probably doing. And it's obviously something that you can only run into in a fantasy game in a highly specific set of circumstances. It's more like something that would be in a kind of science fantasy game, like a Warhammer 40,000 or something like that, where you can easily imagine, you know, demons getting into the machines and the Adeptus Mechanicus sending a bunch of poor fools down there to, like, do the proper rites and slay the unclean spirits. All right, coming in at number two, we've got the Feathered Crab Beast. I am kind of beyond words to describe this one, except that it's a wild composite of different animal forms. But the final step has been taken to kind of embellish it a little bit more and break up its outline in a way that means that it doesn't necessarily look quite like the composition of any real animals necessarily. Like, I think I can tell what some of the parts are. On the other hand, maybe, you know, those little eyes and things were all present on the original models and they're just like, you know, characters from some cartoon I don't know about or something like that. But it's a good example of the final steps making a difference, right? If you put like a crocodile head on a lion's body, that's fine. It's a good monster. But if you really want it to have a distinctive look, then you need to just make a few little changes so that the eye looks at it and goes, well, this is clearly a jumble of familiar shapes, but it's not reducible to something as simple as a moth, a triceratops, and a rhino, or whatever it's actually made out of. I'm not wild about the name, which I think, you know, feathered crab beast, I think might be a little too matter of fact. But I love the combination of body parts from different animals in a way that defies a simple hybrid structure. The upper body, I said, like, it's like a moth, but it's got like a feathered ruff. And now I wonder to what extent this is hiding the join, but that's still clever. And it's got something that maybe is like a triceratops's frill or something like that, but split into two halves. So it has some features that, you know, we don't necessarily see very often in real world animals, which is always a good thing to put on your fantastic animal. The kind of centauroid configuration adds to the sense of weirdness. You know, centaurs are kind of grandfathered in terms of how odd bodies look. But when you have a centauroid creature like a Wemmick or whatever, or a Zoat in Warhammer, there's just something that looks very peculiar about them because it's a hybridization of unfamiliar forms. Rather, you know, most hybrid monsters gain their impact from taking two familiar forms and recombining them in an unfamiliar way. So this thing takes unfamiliar forms and then combines them, or at least combines them in a way that sort of hides their familiarity, whereas a centaur is like, hey, what if a horse was also a dude? I think one thing that you have to do when you're using a monster like this in a fantasy game is you have to give it an attack that's equally weird. You know what I mean? It has to have like a eye beams that turn you invisible or a piercing shriek that spoils your rations or something like that. Because otherwise you run the risk of creating kind of an unintentional letdown when you have a monster that looks totally bizarre, but then it interacts with you in a way that's really mundane. It's a really strange looking creature from some like other dimension with different physical laws, but then it just like bites you or hits you with a sword. Well, you know, that somehow loses some of its otherness, its uncanniness. One thing that I think is really interesting about this is, I mean, if you go and look at the different creatures in the video, you know, that aren't named or whatever, I think you'll see that this is a monster that is weird and kind of gross and different from things that exist in our world, but that has been painted in a very naturalistic style. And I think that helps add to the effect. It's painted as if it was just like, hey, yeah, this is a creature from an alien world. Maybe in that case you want it to be mundane, but and not have some weird attack, but I think you want to keep it strange, right? If it's going to have such a strange appearance, it should have strange powers. Finally, we have the Beeholder. This is a kind of animated beehive-like figure, but like a Wicker Man sort of creature. It's sort of, you can see that parts of it have been torn open to reveal honeycomb inside. The glaze, the sort of honey effect has been done really well. And of course, bees are crawling all over it, crawling in and out. I hate the pun, but on the other hand, I like the idea of an animated beehive, which sounds like something that like a halfling wizard might do to protect her village. It's also something that could fit well into sort of a folk horror context. Beehives have this association with rural life, the idea of the village as a beehive full of the hardworking worker bees, but also the buzz of bees, you know, among the fields, sort of typically suggesting like a quiet day, a lazy day. There's something that makes you sleepy about many bees buzzing as opposed to just one. Maybe I think of a folk horror look to it because of the facial expression, because it looks like it's suffering. It looks either like it doesn't like having all these bees inside it, or alternatively, like it doesn't like being woken up. It doesn't look angry because of the shape of its eyes. It looks sad. It has kind of like a mask of tragedy face on it. I really like that idea, right? That the wizard has animated something and does not consult the thing about whether or not it wanted to be animated. I really like the different layers of texture on this model. I'm not so sure about the bees. I feel like the bees are too large, because this thing will be terrifying because it can unleash swarms of bees. But what we see on the surface of the model are a small number of very large bees. I don't know that a giant beehive construct with like 8 or 9 really big bees inside it is as terrifying as one with zillions of little bees. I think that might be a concept too far, or maybe it's just another example of a giant bee not being as scary as a whole bunch of bees. A giant bee can't fly inside your helmet and crawl all over your face while you like hold still so that it won't sting you. Point is, I feel like this would be a stronger monster if the bees were smaller, but that's something that's much harder to represent as a miniature. So I understand why the creator did it the way they did it. You know, if you are standing or sitting next to the table and you look across the table at a miniature, if you're looking at like realistic humans, the reality is that like a bunch of medieval soldiers or whatever will all kind of blur into looking more or less the same. You know, so bright heraldry and things help them stand out. I mean, I guess much like in real life. But this means that a lot of the time you exaggerate features in order to make them easier to perceive from a distance and make the distinctive features of whatever it is that you're doing stand out more. So this is why, you know, people talk about like, oh, you know, Warhammer figures have these ridiculous swords carved out of 2x4s, or, you know, their shields are a foot thick and so on and so forth. Partly that's for like material reasons, you know, back when they're made out of metal, you don't want them to bend, but it's also partly to exaggerate them in a way that makes them more like visually readable at a greater distance. So I understand having the big bee on there because, you know, at any miniature scale, an actual bee would be minuscule. You know, you wouldn't be able to see it at all. You'd have to somehow represent just a dark cloud, which is possible, I suppose, but it feels like doing this way is easier. So I think that this is a great, you know, boss monster for a village scenario, whether that's because some witch has cursed the beekeeper and the beehives have awoken and are on the rampage, or whether it's because like a good local kid wished to the gods that something would be done to drive away the goblins that were terrorizing the village, and so they animated the beehives. It's a good monster because it calls on a fear and a painful experience that we as players might share. I've never been hit with a mace, or shot with an arrow, or zapped with a lightning bolt, but I have been stung by a bee, and I did not enjoy it. It's relatable. And that's something that you want in that kind of like low-level, folky sort of game. I don't mean low-level necessarily in mechanical terms, but just in kind of the scope and scale of the threat. You could also have these things in a kind of wargaming context as like a military unit in a halfling army. That's funny. I think that's still, there's something fun about that. Bucolic Fantasy Dragon Rampant Army enters the list at like number 35 in projects I'm probably never going to start, let alone finish. Okay, so that's what I took away from this episode, the 2019 Guild Build. If you are interested in making these kinds of things, I recommend the Tabletop Crafters Guild as a place to look at other people doing it. You know, maybe give it a try and see if that's right for you. Nathan, thank you very much for your continued support, and I hope that you enjoyed your episode. Like I said earlier, if you'd like to be like Nathan and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're going to be taking a look at the third major group of dragons, the good chromatic dragons. And we're going to see what you can do with a very powerful entity that's on your side that isn't overshadow the player characters. All of that right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.